From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, there's a major nursing shortage looming in Wisconsin. We'll get two views of the profession on today's show.
First, Mount Mary University teams with two area community colleges to increase the number of bachelor's degree nurses in the region.
Nurses are broadening their medical care and interaction with patients in all types of realms, and so that has then increased even more the demand for nurses.
Later, writer Christy Watson's new memoir is about her two decades spent as a registered nurse. She thinks it's troubling that more men don't go into nursing.
These traits of kindness, care, and compassion are seen as somehow women's traits and therefore possibly seen as less important.
And singer-songwriter Mark Arely celebrates the tradition of the mixtape with his new album, a collection of songs he's covered over the years.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Not long ago, I was looking through the Lake Effect archive for an old interview, and I ran across a show from February of 2009. We chatted with UW-Milwaukee's Sally Lundeen and Marquette University's Margaret Callahan about the looming nursing shortage, which they believe would be more troublesome than those experienced in the past.
I think this one's a little different than ones that we've seen before.
How is it different?
Well, that has to do with the demographic shifts in the country, among other things. There are more of us, and we're getting older, and healthcare has also changed in a way where many more people are in need of and using healthcare services. So as we project this shortage out for the next 10 to 15 years, all the demographics would suggest that it's going to be a sustained shortage unless we address it very soon.
That was Dr. Sally Lundeen of UW-Milwaukee speaking on Lake Effect in 2009 about the looming nursing shortage. 9 years later, the situation has not improved. In fact, it may be more critical. And more institutions are looking for ways to train more nurses. Case in point is Mount Mary University, which recently announced a partnership with Waukesha County Technical College to graduate more bachelor's degree nurses.
That comes on the heels of a similar partnership with Milwaukee Area Technical College. Cheryl Bailey is the Dean of the School of Natural and Health Sciences at Mount Mary, and she's with us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you give us a sense for the current paradigm? How did we get to the point that we're in when it comes to nursing, both locally, regionally, and maybe even on a national scale?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a couple of things. One of them is the growth of the population needing health care, and so therefore we need more health care professionals. And then also the limitations of the schools to be able to graduate the number of nurses for which there are position openings. And part of that reason is because integral and very important to that education is clinical experience. And so the schools work with hospitals to provide clinical experiences as integrated part of the nurse's education. And that has a limitation because of everybody's workforce and everybody's days in the hours in the day that they're able to oversee these students. And so because of that, there's a limitation on how many students can graduate from these nursing programs.
Well, and nurses practice in a variety of settings, not just hospitals, but hospitals are still the place where most of them get their clinical practical mm-hmm. experience.
And I think that brings up another important point is that nurses are broadening their medical care and interaction with patients in all types of realms. And so that has then increased even more the demand for nurses.
Well, and it sounds to me like at the same time, it might build on itself because with a nursing shortage, there are fewer people who go into nursing who are in a position to also teach nursing.
Yes, that is true. There is a shortage in teachers of nursing. And so another shortage comes in that the healthcare organizations are interested in nurses with their experience to move into leadership positions, which is a wonderful idea, and that's something that we're focusing on in our program is leadership development. And so that very positive effect also has an effect of the nurses then leaving the direct health patient care into these leadership positions.
Can you give us a sense for how many nurses are needed in the area?
The Wisconsin Center for Nursing is predicting a need of 20,000 nurses by 2020.
20,000 new nurses by 2020.
Correct. Yes. Bachelor's prepared nurses by 2020.
And this is a year and a half from now.
Yeah, actually, I hadn't realized it is.
Well, and given the current actually, let me take a step back. And these are nurses at a variety of levels or RNs, bachelor's degree nurses versus associate degree nurses or nurses across the board?
This would be bachelor's prepared nurses. And part of that is because of the magnet status of hospitals can be reached in part with 80% of their nurses having a bachelor's degree. And so that's part of this push and need for these 20,000 nurses by 2020.
You're smiling as you say 20,000 nurses by 2020 because it seems like a steep hill to climb.
Yes, a worthy challenge.
Well, so talk about what the various partnerships. There's a new partnership that Mount Mary's announced with WCTC, mm-hmm. Waukesha County Technical College, and an existing partnership with Milwaukee Area Technical College. How do they go after this problem?
Mm-hmm. What we're doing is developing a pathway for students to be able to attain a bachelor's degree in nursing, combining the relative expertise of Mount Mary University and WCTC, for example. And in this case, the students would begin at Mount Mary. Their trajectory is always towards the bachelor degree in nursing. They will satisfy the prerequirements for the WCTC nursing program as they also take courses towards the bachelor's. Those are always in coinciding. They'll be able to complete the associate's degree at nursing at WCTC, obtain, after taking an exam, obtain their RN, and then with that RN be able to, at Mount Mary, complete their Bachelor of Science of Nursing online as they work as an RN, if that's how they choose to do that.
So it's possible that they could get their associate's degree in nursing, obtain their RN, and be practicing nursing even as they work towards getting a bachelor's level nursing degree.
Yes, as they complete that bachelor's degree level nursing degree. Their Mount Mary, the very nice thing about this partnership is that they're Mount Mary students all 4 years. They can take advantage of resources at both campuses, clubs, tutoring, things like that. However, all their financial aid and all of that part of their systems runs through one institution, and that helps them streamline that process and also keep all of that so that they're not running out of eligible financial aid by having it go through one institution. The other thing is that they can live on campus in our residence halls at Mount Mary all 4 years, even while they're taking classes. And we've had a student, for example, whose family has, for a job, moved out of state. She wants to continue here, even when she's taking courses at MATC in this case, and she's delighted that she's able to stay in our residence halls all 4 years of her bachelor's degree.
So does the partnership with MATC work essentially in a similar way to the one with WCTC?
Yes. Everybody has been very collegial. So all of this has worked the same. Curriculum, all of these different components has worked the same. Very few differences. And that's great because then it allows the students to have a clear pathway with Mount Mary and either WCTC or MATC.
And do you have a sense for why one would, is it essentially appealing to people from different geographic parts of the Milwaukee area?
That seems to be the primary differentiator.
What kind of capacity does a program like this have with a need for 20,000 nurses by 2020? Presumably, there are not going to be 20,000 students doing this, but what sort of capacity are we talking about?
So starting out, the numbers are going to sound small. However, this is the first step. With MATC, we have 32 guaranteed seats for our students to progress into their program as long as they meet certain grades and background checks and entrance exam scores as they progress from Mount Mary into their program. And so that's one of the real benefits. They're not petitioning to MATC. They're meeting all those requirements and then joining MATC and starting in that program. With WCTC, it's 16 seats, 8 in the fall and 8 in the spring. So again, those numbers sound small, but that's that many more in that would be for every year. And then we hope to expand beyond that.
Well, I guess, what are the challenges in recruiting people to be to take up nursing as a profession? And, you know, what are the advantages when you reach out to people who are, you know, deciding what kind of coursework they're taking in school?
There's a lot of enthusiasm for being a nurse because people have experienced that often in their lives. We have both types of students. We have a lot of students coming straight from high school. They have ideas about wanting to be a nurse. They're enthusiastic about starting in the program. And then we have some people that are sometimes this could be a second career, or it can be that they started college and then for whatever life happenings prevented them from continuing on. And so we have an interest in helping all of these students with the coursework and the strong student support that we have at Mount Mary University. We have an 81% retention rate, and the reason we have that is because of the culture of student support. And so we're happy with all the students. Some are afraid to go to college in the first place. Some are afraid to go back to college. Some are enthusiastic and ready to get into class. And so we are interested in individually helping every single one of those students.
Is it at all challenging to kind of blend the two campus climates, or really three campus climates?
What we do for that is that we have supports for all different types of students coming in. And so in that case, we do have overlapping and then specialized support. But what we find happens in the classroom is that you have people with life experience, you have people coming in, even the students coming from high school often have some experience that they bring to the table. And that is enriching for all students. And so that we consider to be a benefit when we have as high of a diversity as we can. That helps both cognitive and non-cognitive development of everybody in the classroom.
Still a big challenge ahead.
Yes, it is. And another thing that we're very proud about at Mount Mary in this same regard is that you may not realize we're over 50% women of color. And so we have definitely made very specific supports and environment to be welcoming and to be inclusive. And so we have a high Pell eligible and a high first generation students. And so that only enriches the experience of everybody on campus.
And I would imagine for nursing graduates, they're pretty employable at this point.
Yes, very employable. And so that's where in this program, even before they finish their bachelor's, they would be able to be employed and then continue online to finish that degree. When they're coming to Mount Mary, they can be either part-time or full-time. And then when they're at MATC or WCTC, we are asking for them to be full-time because it helps them to go through those nursing courses as a cohort in the way that they're learning and working together in teams. And so there's the flexibility, and then there's the push in the middle to get that RN so that they can work and then continue finishing the BSN online.
Well, and so how long does it take to go from having that RN to getting the BSN if if they're taking coursework online?
So if they went full-time, it would take, and they went in the summers, it could take as little as 3 semesters. But what we find is the students are feeling comfortable taking 2 courses a semester. So in that case, it's going to take longer. And then sometimes they get revved up and want to take a lot of courses in a semester. So that part-time, full-time will affect how long that takes. Also, that affects how long it takes for them to be ready to start those nursing courses at MATC or WCTC. But we understand that people have all kinds of life happenings, and so we work with that well.
And presumably, once they've gotten to the point where they have the RN, they may well be working a significant amount of the time as well.
Correct. Right. And so that's the students we find are interested in having a part-time experience until they want to just get it done. And then they'll sometimes go full-time.
Are you exploring other potential partnerships or other creative ways of approaching the nursing shortage down the road?
Mm-hmm. So we are interested in looking at some of the other partnerships that would be other community colleges to broaden this, to allow this to expand to more geographic spaces. Yes.
Well, thank you so much. Best of luck in your work, and I hope we can talk again down the road.
All right. Thank you very much.
Dr. Cheryl Bailey is the Dean of the School of Natural and Health Sciences at Mount Mary University. You'll find a link to more about the school's nursing partnerships with MATC and WCTC from a link at wuwm.com.
The nursing shortage is a problem around the world. Over her 20 years as a registered nurse in the UK, Christy Watson became acutely aware of the shortfall in nurses. That's just one issue she addresses in a new memoir about her time as a nurse. We'll speak with her when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Before the break, we talked about one effort to alleviate Wisconsin's nursing crisis. But the nursing gap has also been building around the world, like in the UK, where Christy Watson worked as a registered nurse for 20 years before becoming a novelist and pursuing writing full-time.
Following two novels, her latest book is a memoir of her time as a nurse. The Language of Kindness is a story of her evolution in the field, but also a meditation on the role nurses play in medicine and what the rest of us might take from the compassion dispensed along with more traditional medical care. Christy Watson joined us via Skype from the UK. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
There are a lot of medical memoirs out there, but it seems like maybe very few are written from the perspective of nurses. What do you think we have lost by not often hearing that side of the story?
I think it's a complicated issue. I think that the layperson's perspective is often that nursing and medicine is quite a similar job, and actually it's completely different. They're two distinct specialties and two very different jobs. But I also think that, yes, we have lost some things. We've lost the value of compassion and care and kindness. And I think this has resulted in a lack of nurses, not just in America, but worldwide. We're having all kinds of problems in England as well. Because people aren't aspiring to be nurses because they don't really understand what the job is, because there's not enough out there about the job. And certainly literature and memoirs play a part in that, I think.
What do you think the misconceptions about what the job are? What do people expect from nursing, and how does it compare with the reality?
I think the misconceptions, because it's such a complicated job and it's very difficult to get into language, nursing isn't just one thing or another. It's not a science or an art or humanities. It's all of the things. It's everything you can possibly imagine. It's maths and chemistry and biology and physics and politics and art and psychology and sociology and literature. And it's everything you can absolutely imagine in one job. So it's very hard to define, which I think is part of the problem, and that's been some of the issue. But at its core, since the beginning of time, nursing has been about kindness and care and compassion and helping those who need help.
And this is a period in our history where kindness and compassion are somewhat in short supply across the board.
Absolutely. And also our patient population is changing so much. We're aging at such a rapid rate. Our problems are becoming much more complicated. Patients aren't coming into hospital with just one curable disease that can rely on technology or drugs or advances in medicine. People are coming into hospital with complex social care needs, mental health issues. They're lonely. They're suffering with old age, with anxiety, with existential fear, with all kinds of issues, as well as physical problems. And so the medical model that we've used for so long doesn't work for these patients. And that's why nurses have never worked harder and never been busier, because these are the patients that need the technical skill that nurses have, but also the kindness, and compassion that nurses have.
One of the things that really kind of strikes me is, you know, the world has changed in one sense in that today there are as many or almost as many women graduating from medical school as men in many places. But in most countries, the vast majority of nurses are still women. Is that a problem, do you think?
Yes, I think it's a problem. I think that it would be lovely if all jobs were gender equal. I mean, there's great benefits for that. But it also says so much about what we value and what we don't value and our value system in terms of gender, because 90% of nurses in the UK are women. We're really struggling with getting men into nursing. And I think that's because it's seen as somehow a feminine job. These traits of kindness, care and compassion are seen as somehow women's traits, and therefore possibly seen as less important. And that's quite a terrifying prospect.
Well, and with such a shortage of nurses in so many places, it seems like to essentially exclude an entire gender is, you know, missing out on a potentially enormous source of you know, alleviation for, you know, an enormous way to go at that nursing shortage.
Well, it's certainly not nurses that are excluding the gender.
Right.
We absolutely love men to join nursing. And, you know, I think it's harmful to masculinity to assume that men can't be kind and compassionate as well as technically able and skilled as the women nurses are. We would love more men in nursing. And so I think this is about society and patriarchy, and it's about misogyny overall. And I really do hope that more men do join nursing. It's such a valuable and varied profession, and there is something in it for everybody. But to assume that a particular trait is feminine or masculine is, I think, very, very damaging to society.
Your book is called The Language of Kindness. Do you look at nursing as its own kind of language?
I look at nursing as almost a faith in itself. It's a faith in human beings and people's inherent good. And it's a faith that you can love a stranger effectively, because you are actually giving that much of yourself as a nurse. You're going on a journey with this person. You're there by their side through the deepest, darkest hours of their life. And you're holding the hands of a person at the most significant and extreme and frail moments of their life. And so it is a language. It's a language that's difficult to get into words. It's abstract and it's quite metaphorical, but it is a faith in humanity.
What we think of as kindness has also evolved over time. I mean, you write about a point in the history of medicine and nursing when kids would be in the hospital and the thought was the most kind thing that we can do for them is not let their parents see them or not let them see their parents. How is nursing evolving to incorporate emotions, not just the emotions of the patients, but the emotions of the nurses as well?
I think that it's more acceptable now to cry with your patients than perhaps it was before. But that's also a kind of journey that I've been on, I think, because I didn't used to think it was very acceptable. I used to think that you used to have a stiff upper lip and really try not to express emotions because it would somehow make your patient feel even worse or the relatives feel worse. But I think it's really important to show how much you do care, because you really do care that much. And quite often you're holding back tears during some very difficult situations. And so I think it's becoming more acceptable in nursing to show that you're caring for your patient, but you're also feeling sadness for them, and you can cry with them and laugh with them and have all these emotions with them, to know that you are really traveling this journey with them while they're in hospital.
You describe your time in a variety of hospital settings in what we would call the emergency department, the pediatric ward, the special care nursery, oncology, gerontology, your work as a resuscitation nurse. How common is it for a nurse to move from one specialty area to the next?
Well, I didn't work in all those areas. I worked mainly in pediatric intensive care. And then I went on to become a resuscitation nurse. And as a resuscitation nurse, I went to all those areas that you spoke about.
Oh, sure.
In the hospital. But during my pediatric intensive care training, I spent some time on special care baby unit as well. which was amazing. So I think there are these sort of hybrid jobs in most hospitals where you have something like a resuscitation team that travels everywhere from the staff canteen to accident and emergency to the oncology wards. And I think it gave me a very unique insight in a way into the hospital as a whole living, breathing being in itself. So I was able to glimpse all the wards and all the areas between the wards, from patient transport to the staff canteen. So that was very, very useful in terms of writing the book.
Why was it so important for you to write this book? Was there some hope that you don't write explicitly about a public policy challenge at the end of it, but would you hope your book makes a difference in some way?
I really do. I really hope that it has a positive impact on nurse recruitment around the world, because obviously we're in crisis. But also more than that, that lay people have a real understanding of what nurses do and have a really positive image, because we get many, many negative images of nursing, and it's newsworthy most of the time to hear about a nurse that's had bad practice or done something. But it's actually very, very rare. And most of the nurses in the vast majority of the time are excellent and provide absolutely excellent care to their patients, despite the pressures that they're under day after day after day, which I think is something to really celebrate.
Did I read correctly that you are in a process of helping develop a TV series on nursing?
Yes, which is very exciting. So I'm working with Mammoth Screen, who developed Poldark and Victoria, which were two big shows here. And we are working to dramatize a series about nursing based on the book, but loosely based on the book. And I really want to try and produce a series that is realistic and shows the job really as it is, not in a glamorous sense, not in a nostalgic sense, but actually this is what the job is, because I think it is very hard for people to know what nurses do unless they're either nurses or have a nurse in the family, or they've been into hospital many, many times themselves. And then I think people do have an appreciation of just how hard nurses work and just how skilled they are as well.
There is a bit of over-glamorizing in a lot of the popular culture when it comes to how medicine is portrayed.
Yes, I agree.
Do you have any guilt, if that's the right word, about writing about nursing from the outside, or did it take leaving the profession to be able to write about it and your place in it?
Well, I'm still registered as a nurse, actually. So I don't work on the wards anymore, but I juggled nursing and writing and teaching for a long time, because I found that it was quite tricky to leave. I didn't want to leave the register. But actually, I've come to the point now where I want to dedicate the next part of my life to advocating for nurses and to working in a policy-making sense, if at all possible. I've been asked to join an international campaign run by a lord we have here called Lord Crisp, called Nursing Now, which is aiming to raise the profile of nurses around the world. And I'm really looking forward to getting involved in that kind of thing. So I'll still be dedicated to nursing, but not on the wards anymore.
I would think that you have a certain appreciation that most people do not when you or a family member has to have medical care, though.
Yeah, so the spark for this book really came from 6 years ago when I was on the other side of the fence and my dad was dying from lung cancer. And I'd been a nurse by then for many, many years, but it was only truly by watching his nurse and taking a step back, and the small actions that she did made the biggest difference to my whole family. And she still now is in touch with us. She came to my dad's funeral on her day off. She still pops in to see my mum now, 6 years after my dad died. She wrote me an email a few weeks ago saying that my dad would be forever in her thoughts. And so she made our whole family feel like we were the only family that she was working with. And yet, obviously, we weren't. She works with many, many families. And I suddenly realized, hang on, this is the job that I do. And this is the job that all nurses do. And they really give that much of themselves. And yet, I just hadn't considered how important and what a huge privilege it was until that point. And I think that's the thing that really spurred me on to want to write about nursing.
Well, Christy Watson, you have done a wonderful job, and it really does, it certainly opened my eyes, and I hope it opens the eyes of many more people. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Christy Watson's memoir is called The Language of Kindness, A Nurse's Story. It's out today, and Watson worked as a nurse for 20 years before pursuing writing full-time. She's also the author of two novels, the more recent of which is called Where Women Are Kings. We spoke with her via Skype from the UK.
One more break now, and then an in-studio performance from singer-songwriter Mark Arelli. His new album is a collection of cover tunes he's played over the years. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Fare you well, my honey. Fare you well, my only true one. All the birds that were singing.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Mark Arelli's voice has terrific range, and while that's evident on just about any of his albums he's recorded over the years, the range that's most apparent on his latest album isn't his voice. It's his ability to credibly cover songs from Against All Odds by Phil Collins to this song by the Grateful Dead.
Cover songs have been part of Arelli's mix for years, including an annual all-cover show that he does. His latest album is a collection of covers appropriately called Mixtape. Mark Arelli played a show recently at the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson, but he joined us in the studio, accompanied by Jake Armerding, and they started with the aforementioned song by the Grateful Dead called Broke Down Palace.
On the bank's green edge, it will grow. Sing a lullaby, only sigh the water. Oh, lovers come and go. The river rolls, rolls, rolls. Oh, fare you well, I love you more than words can tell. Listen to the river sing sweet songs to rock my soul. Doo-doo-doo. Doo-doo-doo.
Great stuff.
Thanks, man.
Broke Down Palace, the Grateful Dead, as channeled by Mark Arelli and Jake Armerding. Welcome to both of you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Oh, thrilled to have you here. What revs you up about playing other people's songs?
Well, you know, I started out as a music fan, right, before I knew how to play music. And so covering other people's songs kind of connects me back to that part of myself, or at least ideally hopefully means that I never lose that part. So anytime that, you know, there might be any kind of weariness, even a slight tinge of weariness setting in with, you know, being me, I can, and not that it's hard to be me, but just my suite of melodic choices and the experiences that I draw on from my lyrics. I mean, I am limited in my own imagination. So when I get to step inside someone else's imagination and cover their songs, it kind of shows me other lands that I might be able to go to, you know, eventually on my own. And it ends up influencing my own stuff.
Well, and I wondered whether you approach a song like that thinking, well, I'm going to put a Mark Arelli stamp on the song, or whether it expands what you think of as a Mark Arelli stamp.
Well, the only thing that you cover verbatim is the Beatles. There's nothing you can do to improve upon that. Everything else is fair game. I kind of feel like if I'm going to sing someone else's songs, you know, I have plenty of my own. If I'm going to sing someone else's songs, I want to be able to bring something to it. And, you know, yeah, it could be an iconic artist like the Grateful Dead or, you know, Roy Orbison or something like that. But you have to believe, in my book, you have to believe that you have something to bring to the tradition around this song, or else stay away and just listen to it.
Well, and it's interesting to think of the idea of a cover, because I you know, there are a lot of musicians who start by just covering other people's songs.
Sure.
And then they get to the point where they have their own catalog of songs. And it sounds like what you're saying is there has to be a point where you have enough confidence in your own material to be willing to go back and reevaluate those songs that other people played, and, you know, feel comfortable enough in your own skin to play them yourself again.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I could have made this record, which kind of has grew out of an annual cover show that Jake and I have done with other artists in Boston for 14 years now. I could have, we've been talking about making this record for a long time. I could have done this 7, 8, 9 years ago, but I wasn't the artist or the singer that I was then, that I am now then, and I didn't have as much experience under my belt, you know, in life. So I'm really glad that I waited as long as I did and brought to it everything that I have now, because I think I'm better off now than I would have been earlier on.
The collection is called Mixtape, or Mixtape for You.
Right? I call it Mixtape, but, you know, in the album art, I couldn't resist putting in a little flourish of, you know, For You, Love, M-E, which a lot of people, you know, read me, but those are actually my initials, which is always, you know, problematic whenever I have to, you know, sign a legal document. They're like, oh, you are initialing this. I'm like, no, that is, I'm actually me.
The cover art is cassette-like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking we're probably around the same generation here.
Sure.
I was wondering, do you think our cassette kids kind of the lost generation of music?
Well, it certainly was like a tweener generation between a format that had been around for a long time, you know, vinyl, and the CD, I think, probably had a longer run than cassettes. And, you know, I don't want to romanticize the medium of cassettes too much. They sounded horrible and they were a bit unwieldy, and, you know, anyone that complains about album art size on a CD cover, you know, obviously never transitioned to cassettes, because they're
even
smaller.
Remember reading a lyric sheet on a cassette?
Yeah, they're half as big as the CDs. But, you know, every format has its limitations, and that forces you to listen to the music and interact with it in a certain way. And for making a mixtape, I mean, you really had to, like, hover with those fingers over the play and record button as the radio DJ was, announcing the song, and hope that they didn't talk over the beginning, and then you had to stop it right before they, you know, started to back announce the song. So, you know, it just forced a real tactile and intense engagement with the music and in listening, as opposed to just, well, I'll just drag this song over here into this playlist and, you know, burn a CD, that kind of thing. That kind of focused listening, I mean, Jake and I were just talking about this. Any time you put focused listening into music, it's going to sound better to you than not, regardless of the format. So CDs sound great, albums sound great. You could even argue that there's a certain, you know, quality to tapes too. As long as you're focused on music, it rewards, because it's a different kind of, you know, medium. You can listen to music in the background of doing other things. That's partly what gives it its power, is like being the soundtrack of our lives. But it's also what makes us maybe take it for granted sometimes, you know? If you're going to go see a movie and you don't look at the movie, you can't say you watched the movie. If you go through a museum with your eyes closed, you didn't see the art, you know? Whereas music, it can be kind of playing, processed in the background, but it can also, if you turn and listen to it directly, it can be a very meaningful experience too.
And interestingly, to think about those first mixtapes that we made when you were there trying to record the song that you wanted as it was playing on the radio, these are mixtapes that you made for yourself.
Sure, you can make them for yourself. I mean, I made a lot of them, you know, in high school and junior high. I was making a lot of them for, you know, other people. I would make some for my male friends as well, like, check this out, this is music that matters to me. But for the most part, I was using them to give to females. And ostensibly, you'd be saying, like, check out this music. This really matters to me. But really what you're saying is, like, you matter to me. And, you know, it wasn't just engaging with the mixtape on like a logistical level, like when to hit play and record and when to hit stop. It was like, well, what is the singer saying in this song? What do I want to express to this person that I maybe as a 14-year-old don't have the language for yet?
Well, I hope we can hear another song from the new album.
Absolutely. Let's do a song by the band here. This is one of my favorite band songs called Ophelia.
Boards on the window, mail by the door. What would anybody leave so quickly for? Ophelia, where have you gone? The old neighborhood just ain't the same. Nobody knows just what became of Ophelia. Tell me what went wrong. Was it something that somebody said? Mama, know we broke the rule. Was somebody up against the law? Honey, you know that I died for of laughter. The ghost is clear. Why do the best things always disappear? Like Ophelia. Oh, please darken my door.
Ophelia, nice job.
Thank you.
Hey, you look like you were enjoying that.
Absolutely, man. This is the best job in the whole world.
You were saying that the album actually is sort of the natural outgrowth of this annual concert that mm-hmm. you do. Was there a conscious effort when you made the record or the tape or the recording to kind of capture the feel of that performance?
Not the feel of the performance, though. Two things were very important to me. One, all the material was drawn from songs that I've done at the shows over the years, with the exception of the Grateful Dead song, which I did this past year when the record was released. So I wanted to draw on, you know, stuff that had been kind of audience tested and gone over well. And I also wanted to make sure that everybody that was on the show and part of this show, because the lineup has shifted over the years, I wanted to make sure that they were all part of the record. So, you know, Jake is singing and playing on the record, But the core of the record is actually a very different sound for me with strings. I'd never had strings on a record before, and I'd never worked with this particular drummer before, Ray Rizzo, that plays on the record, and that can be very foundationally changing for a record. So, you know, I wasn't so concerned that it represent what we do on stage sonically, but I wanted the spirit to be kind of drawn from there.
I guess, that's what I was wondering, is maybe the show being once a year, this at least sort of kicks that spirit, you know, into the 364 days that the show isn't on stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually been really fun. We did a whole run of cover shows with the band, and I did basically probably 75% covers and 25% of my own material. And I know that there were some people in my audience that, you know, they wanted just a little bit more of my original songs, and I really appreciate the intention behind that feeling. But, you know, this is just, it's important for me to stop for every once in a while and just celebrate music. And it's hard to do that if I'm playing I have the same feeling of joy and celebration when I'm playing my own stuff, even though I look like I'm in pain when I sing it. But it's hard to celebrate music playing your own songs. I'm sure there's some people with egos that are, you know, would have no problem with that. But for me, it's very important to kind of put myself aside and celebrate, you know, the purity of it. And so it really keeps me going.
You could almost do a KTEL commercial and scroll the names of the songs in front of you as you
sing.
That
would be great. Maybe that would sell records. Who knows? We could be back to that.
You have also done some work. You've covered specifically in a bluegrass style was the Barnstar Project?
Barnstar, yep. Yep, Jake Armerding and his dad are both in Barnstar with me, along with my friend Zach Hickman and Charlie Rose on banjo. And yeah, the Barnstar thing it started out as more covers than originals. And I think over the years, as we kind of sporadically get together, we've been kind of trying to nudge it more towards at least equal numbers of covers and originals. And, you know, that's a chance to recontextualize things in kind of, you know, more of a string band kind of context, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I wondered if it was scratching, if not the same itch, but kind of a related itch.
Definitely. I mean, what the Barnstar thing provides me primarily is a chance to stand around, you know, huddle around these two mics on the same mic stand with five other guys and really be literally shoulder to shoulder and kind of, you know, it's like a band of brothers kind of thing. A lot of the times I'm not even fortunate enough to have like a single side man. It's usually just me and my guitar up there. And that's great. That's a thing. And I stand by that. But as a mode of being in the world, it's pretty lonely. And so to play with the bluegrass band, it just kind of, it's like being in a gang a little bit, you know, but a gang for good.
And when you're with bluegrass, a gang for good,
yeah.
I think we have the headline for
plus whiskey.
But it sounds like, to go back to what you were saying a little earlier, when you're with four or five other guys on the stage, you're also, I mean, not that you wouldn't ever be present with your music to begin with, but you really do have to be present because, you know, the five people on stage are all relying on each other.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have to play and sing with each other and kind of feed on each other's dynamics. And then the way we play, you know, we don't use monitors or plug in anything. So we physically have to revolve around the mics and mix ourselves. And if we haven't done that in a while, that choreography gets a little bit rusty. and there's definitely been some bumped head stocks over the years. But it really keeps you very present and very focused. And that's the place where I think the best art comes from. So all these things are just ways of tricking myself to kind of stay invested and not coast on anything or, you know, develop two kind of set patterns.
Before we get to the end of this, I'm sort of staring at your guitar. It's well worn, and I feel like I owe it to the process to ask if there is a story behind that guitar.
Oh yeah, this is the only physical possession in my life that means anything. I could let everything go. You know, obviously we're not talking about family and loved ones, but physical possessions. This guitar is made for me by a guy named T.J. Thompson, who is not a well-known guitar maker, you know, generally, but in very succinct circles. He is the dude. And he has become a fan and a really good friend. And he offered to make me a guitar, and I couldn't say no. And he just nailed it. It's an old piece of wood on the top, though it looked brand new when I first got it, and I've just beaten it up. That's why it looks that way. but the wood, the top piece is from the 20s, an old piece of Adirondack spruce. And then the side and back are koa. Can't see it on the radio, but
might take some pictures of it.
Yeah, so you know, I like to tell people it's like it's like having the wisdom and experience of old age in like a teenager's body. who wouldn't want that? You know,
wow.
I'd kill for that.
Like a Karate Kid moment.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is my baby.
I'm honored you brought it with you, Mark and Jake. Thank you both so much. Safe travels, and come back and see us.
I would love to. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
And what are you going to play us out with?
We'll play you out with an older song of mine, going back 10 years now. It's hard to believe I'm saying that. It's called Baltimore, from a record I put out in 2008 called Delivered.
It's an 8-hour drive up to Somerville, to Somerville, to Somerville. I got a big cup of coffee and a bottle of little white pills, little white pills, little white pills. I turn the radio up 'cause I just wanna hear the sound. Someone's voice, yeah, someone's voice. Mr. State Trooper, please don't stop me now. I can't slow down, and I got no choice. Well, I come flying north the Delaware and across the Tappan Zee, wondering what I gotta do to make you reconsider me. Well, honey, don't turn me back from your door. Well, I come out all the way from Baltimore. I got a pawn shop ring and a yellow rose bouquet, yeah. Honey, that I bought in some cheap truck stop. The heart that seems enough to prove to you I've changed, yeah. And maybe it ain't, but it's all I got. Well, I know you've had all the heartaches you can take from me, so I won't make no excuses for the fool I used to be. Well, honey, don't turn me back from your door. I come out all the way from Baltimore. Hey, now.
That was Mark Arelli and Jake Armerding. Arelli's new album is called Mixtape. He visited us in studio recently before a concert at the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson. Our in-studio session was engineered by John Strelecki and mixed by Jason Reavy. And Mark Arelli closes out the Tuesday edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.
Oh, I did it in six. Oh, I did it.